And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
With mid-August slipping past us, summer's heading towards a wrap. So now's the time to get out and grab whatever you can of what's left and make the most of it. We're going to talk about some creative ways to enjoy your time outdoors and visit an old friend to see how he's doing. It's all coming up when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
There's a strange irony in the news these days. The good news is that the world is accepting global warming as real. The good news is that people are awakening to the fact that we are seriously impacting our Earth, lopping off whole mountaintops for coal, witnessing more frequent oil spills all over the Earth. It's good that we are aware of these factors. We're making progress. So, to celebrate today, we're taking an excursion into some fun realms. We start off heading to Manhattan to talk with Lincoln Kareem, who is a central player in the saga of Pale Male, the red-tailed hawk of New York City. The reaction worldwide to the destruction of Pale Male's nest was enormous. People built him a new safe place to reconstruct his nest. So how are things going for Pale Male? That's coming up following the news. Then in segment two, digital photography has really changed the nature of photography. I'm sure most of you love your new digital cameras. It never hurts to get a few pointers, though, from an expert on how to make your photos come to life. We talked to a Kodak expert who has a lot of simple pointers to better photos. And then in segment three, some of the most listened to segments in the archives are the special drawing and art features I've done over the past years. So, it's time for another segment, and this time, I cover 5 secrets to better nature drawing. So get out your pencils and sketch pads, because these are simple techniques that will help anyone draw anything. And so, with a great late summer tribute to the creative spirit on its way, we'd best get on with today's news. So now, the news. Oil spills keep making the news. A Japanese tanker lost about 1.4 million gallons of crude oil into the eastern Indian Ocean following the collision with a large cargo ship. The spill took place 300 miles off the west coast of India's Nicobar Islands. The ship itself was carrying 77.6 million gallons of crude. The largest spill ever recorded, of course, was the Exxon Valdez, which lost 11 million gallons of crude off the coast of Alaska in 1989. Meanwhile, the Philippines are sending ships towards the central island of Guaymas to assess and hopefully stem the impact of the country's likely largest oil spill. Aerial surveys estimate that the spill is covering fully 15 square nautical miles as a result of 2 million liters of crude that have already leaked into the oceans. This is the second such spill in the last 8 months. Spain is feeling the results of the driest year on record, resulting in water reserves falling to their lowest point ever recorded. Some of the reserves are at 43.9% of capacity. Therefore, irrigation water is being rationed in parts of the country, which is expected to impact Spain's agricultural output. As well, the power industry is having to cut back on electric power generation, which is impacting the economic stability of the region. Late summer rains are expected to fall this week, but generally have little effect on replenishing the seriously low levels in the nation's water reservoirs. Too much of a good thing can be bad. That seems to be the assessment of botanist David Taylor of the U.S. Forest Service, who is monitoring the levels of poaching of slippery elm bark from trees primarily in the Daniel Boone forests of Kentucky. Slippery elm bark is a naturally soothing throat remedy which gained its legends in the deep woods by backcountry folk. But the $23 billion herbal industry unfortunately has its greedy practitioners who are poaching the bark from trees to meet the needs of millions of users of this wonder elixir. Stripping bark results in the death of the tree. Agents are beginning to use sophisticated tagging approaches to help track illegally harvested elm bark. Perhaps the biggest setback from this abuse is the damaged legacy of earth-friendly remedies associated with natural medicine. If you know of anyone involved in illegal harvesting of any natural plant, tree, or shrub, report him or her to a Forest Service representative immediately. It may be time to stock up on some fresh ginkgo biloba lozenges, which hold the claim for being a very effective mind and memory strengthener, as newly negotiated definitions of what constitutes planets is promising to raise the number from 9, which we all manage to remember, to 12, and hold on, ultimately, up to 53 members of the solar system. In the emerging new solar systemics, Pluto will be joined by 3 other planets, namely Ceres, Charon, and UB313, not necessarily in that order. So the new planetary lineup would read as follows. Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Ceres, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, Charon, and UB313, which had been named Xena, but will likely find a more astronomically correct appellation in the years ahead. And that's the news. And a reminder, some exciting new features are coming up in the weeks ahead. Tune in. And now we look back a bit. It's time we track on a story that captivated the world in a cold December in 2004. One of the things I like to do on the Wild Side News is to make sure that when we introduce an interesting story that we follow up and find out what's happening, because that's what happens in life and nature. And there was a story that we covered about a red-tailed hawk in New York City, the legendary pale male. And also part of that story, a huge part of that story, was probably the world's largest fan of pale male, and that's Lincoln Kareem, who got himself very much involved right in the middle of this saga of pale male. Lincoln, welcome back to the Wild Side News.
Thank you for having me.
Just for listeners who maybe are unfamiliar with the story of pale male, why don't you give a real quick history of what of pale male and sort of your relationship to pale male?
Pale male is a red-tailed hawk that was discovered in Central Park in 1991. I lived in New York City at the time, but I never really followed him. I didn't know anything about him. And I was busy doing other things, so I never bumped into him, so to speak. I'm not a big television fan, or didn't find out about him until very late, until about the year 2000. And that's when I got involved. Pale male is just a hawk that was on his migratory path from north to south in 1991, when he was a very young hawk, probably less than a year old, decided to stay in Central Park, found a good food supply, and he's been here ever since.
You sort of came across pale male, people paid attention to it, but then you got very involved in really bringing the story of pale male to the visitors and residents of New York City as you'd be going through Central Park. Talk about how that came about.
I'm definitely a big fan of pale male, and I never really planned to become such a big fan. It's almost like an obsession now, even if obsession is a pretty tough word. Many people who follow him, you know, just through the season. Some of them think of him as a novelty. Some of them use him as a centerpiece to socialize on and stuff. But I think I see more than just a novelty in him. I see it from all different angles. I even see him as a Native American coming back to Manhattan. You know, it's all different things that I really can't put into words. But basically, he's just one beautiful creature that I love to look at every day.
Well, he took up residence high up on a building in New York, and that's where kind of the story took a turn. You began to really focus on Pale Male with a very high-power telescope and camera, began to follow his actions as he began to set up a nest and find a mate on a ledge in New York City. Talk about that, too.
Yes, part of the reason why he's so popular, because he does have 22 chicks so far, and they are building nests on various places in New York City, but none of them could get the fame of him because of this particular building. It's a very ritzy building on Fifth Avenue, and it's sort of almost like a centerpiece around what is called a model sailboat pond in Central Park. It's at 74th Street and Fifth Avenue. A lot of very famous people live in this building, and yes, a telescope that I set up helped to introduce more people to him. And it's no one passes by that pond these days without pointing up and saying that's where the hawk nest lived. That's where that hawk nest resides.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, of course, there was a day when the residents and owners of the building decided that they'd had enough of this bird, and they destroyed the nest.
Right. This nest has been active for 11 years, and every year it's almost like clockwork. He has chicks. They fly out. Everyone comes out. They watch their chicks grow up. It's been part of life in New York City. And for some reason, which threw everyone off, on December 7th, 2004, I received a call one rainy day when no one was looking at this nest. I was in a coffee shop at that time. And I got a call from someone who lives just north of this nest building telling me that there are workmen on the building removing the nest. I ran straight over without any cameras or anything, and it has to be one of the saddest moments in my life to actually look up there and see that nest being destroyed. Nobody knows why they took it down, and I could give you reasons, but we'd never really know why. But it just seems that they got fed up of all the attention that this nest was bringing, and decided to take it down. And I believe they thought nothing would come out of it, just a few people grumbling, and that was going to be the end. But
well, they sure miscalculated there.
It was definitely a big miscalculation.
Yeah, because literally the story went around the world.
It definitely went around the world, and people just got involved. People started writing in. Everyone realized maybe they were awakened to what we are doing to animals all around the world, destroying their homes and stuff, and Pale Male's nest destruction was that catalyst to make more and more people aware of it. And we had to fight for this one nest. And, of course, you know, I got arrested and stuff for yelling and screaming, unfairly, I believe, even if I don't want to talk about that now. But he got his nest back. However, since that nest was rebuilt, he did have eggs for 2 years in a row, and they never hatched.
That's what I wanted to find out, is what's happened since you know, because they did build a beautiful, it really was quite interesting how it came about.
It's beautiful. It's not beautiful at all to me, because that nest structure that they built, they did not listen to me. I gave them 12 high-resolution images from every angle that I had of that original nest, and I begged them to put it back originally as it was before, and they swore that they're going to build it better than it was before. Stronger, better, more ventilated, and yeah, it probably looks architecturally better, but it's not. For 2 years now, the eggs weren't hatching.
Mm. Well, that's what I want to find out. Just as I say, some people aren't familiar with the story. One of New York's premier architects designed a metal structure, a steel structure, but the question then was, what will happen? So that's where I want to pick up the story, and that is that he has come back and built nests and brought in a mate. Now tell us what's been going on.
The nest was rebuilt once that structure was put in place and once all the scaffolding and stuff was removed within hours of it going back up, he started building it back. In fact, he never stopped rebuilding from the day it was removed. So the nest was rebuilt. They had eggs in 2005. They did not hatch. He had eggs in 2006. They did not hatch. Nobody knows why. And he's not complaining. He's continuing. Lola, who was his mate since 2002, is still his mate, and they're still together. And I don't know what will happen next, honestly.
Mm-hmm. So they are still residents now, but for whatever reason it is, the eggs aren't coming to...
Eggs aren't hatching. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're freezing. Nobody really knows what is happening. Mm-hmm. The New York City Audubon Society, who is not really a big fan of mine, is spreading or trying to indicate that he might be sterile. I refuse to accept that. It could be true. I don't know. But it's unforgivable for saying something like that about him. And as I said, even if it might be true, it's just too much of a coincidence that all of a sudden his nest was destroyed and all of a sudden he becomes sterile.
I guess we don't have the answer, do we?
We do not.
Yeah.
The beautiful part about it is that he's still around. Lola is still around. They're still sleeping most nights in the same tree together. They fly together, and it's just beautiful to watch them every day.
Now whether
the eggs hatch or not, still something to watch every day.
Mm-hmm. That is the update. So although efforts were made to try to bring the nest back to its original location with this cage of sorts, unfortunately, there are no offspring since that time.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. But you keep busy photographing, and I'd actually like to focus on that because I revisited your website, and Lincoln, I'm absolutely stunned at what a magnificent photographer you are. You are truly the website, and by the way, let's give that website now so that people who may be listening even may be able to go there and look at some of the images.
It's palemale.com, palemale.com.
You have literally a collection on your website of absolutely exquisite photographs going back in time with Pale Mail that tells the story in so many ways. And I've looked at a lot of photographs in my life, and you have some spectacular photographs of Pale Mail in the city, as well as the offspring and other elements. I encourage people to take a look. Talk a little bit about how you spend your time now. You're probably expanding out your interest in the offspring and following them as well.
Yeah, I try my best to visit other nests of his offspring and their babies and stuff like that. However, it takes a toll on me, and I try to limit it as much as I can and spend more time with him. I don't want people to forget about him, and even if he had babies, even up to this year, he had grandchildren, which were born in the St. John the Divine Cathedral up at 113th Street. And I try to go up there as much as possible, but I don't want to distract from him, you know, purely on the sake that there's a nest with babies in it. I want people to realize that babies aren't everything. And he still has a lot to teach and learn, this Pale Male, and we don't know how long he's going to be around. To me, he'd always be around, but I try to spend as much time with him as much as I can. And as far as the photography is concerned, I don't consider myself any great photographer.
Well, I beg to differ. You have some great photographs on your website.
They are great, and And I'm not trying to be overly modest or anything, but the reason why they're great is because I concentrate on him himself. I don't try to read magazines and try to copy other people. I just want to photograph him exactly how I see him. I don't use any flash. I don't use any compositing, no photoshopping or anything like that, just natural light. I photograph him in the rain and the snow, in the heat, in the any sort of weather that I find. Exactly how I find him is exactly how I photograph him. And he just brings out the photograph. It's hardly anything to do with me.
Well, you've watched Pale Male in more than anybody else in the world. There's no doubt about that. And I'm just curious, in all of that time, if there have been moments where he's done something that you found surprising or that brought special meaning to your life. I'd love to know how this long-term relationship with this bird is beginning to really affect you.
Sometimes I try, and people believe that we have some sort of relationship. In a fantasy world, we do. In reality, he is totally isolated, I believe. And I love that. He should not try to communicate with us at all because we have nothing to tell him. He has enough to tell us, and that is what I try to do. I try to listen to him and watch him. And yet, every day I go out there, even if it's spots that I've photographed a million times before, every day I get a new picture. Every day I see something different about him. I see him playing in puddles. I see him actually like a little kid stomping on puddles of water and making splashes. I see when it rains, he does not shelter the rain. He goes to the top of the trees and open his wings to get the rain beating down on him. It's really, really beautiful to watch. Every day I get a completely different photograph that I have not had before. It's never boring. I learn something new about him every day, and even if it means rushing up to just see him perched on a branch that I've seen so many times before, it's getting me away from the drudgery of regular life in New York City. Mm-hmm. And that's a plus every single day.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about what you've learned about Pale Male as a being, because I'm prepared to, I'm with you, I believe that these are individuals and they have their own personalities.
He's certainly an individual. Life in New York City, just walk in the street. I try not to be too bitter about human beings. And I am a human being. I try not to forget that. But you look around, everyone on the subway has an iPod plugged into their ear. They wear dark glasses. They smoke cigarettes. They drop it on the street. They forget that, you know, we live on this earth. And these animals never do. Everything they do with the earth, even if they eat off the earth, even if they pick branches off a tree to build their nest, they live and they love the earth. They would never do anything to destroy it. You would never see Pale Male or any animal, including bacteria, destroy the earth maliciously like we do, you know, to continue living. And that's what we do every day. We make a hobby out of it. We chop down trees for no reason. We kill animals for no reason. We kill them for sport. And no animal that I've ever seen in my life do this. Some people say beavers cut trees down unnecessarily, and that is just so ridiculous to say. Whatever they do, even if they chop those trees down, it's for some good reason, unlike us. And that is what they have to teach. Look at them. Look at roaches on the street. Look at rats in the subway. They're not destroying anything. They're just living in tune with the earth, unlike us. And that is what I learn, and that's what I try to teach people around me. Anyone who scorns a rat or a cockroach or other, you know, unpopular animals, I try to tell them they're doing something wholesome and noble.
They're not asking.
What we're doing, smoking cigarettes, dropping it in the street, there's nothing good about that. Nothing good comes out of something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's not a lot of politics involved in the wild creatures trying to hack out their existence. I'm sure a lot of people would be curious, how does Pale Male survive? What does he eat? What is his life like?
His main diet are rats. And in order of his popular foods, it will be rats, pigeons, mice, squirrels, and small birds. On one occasion, and I did not witness it myself, but some credible person told me once he ate a mallet, a turtle pond. But that has to be once in 15 years.
Well, now you're still camped out in the park quite a bit with your camera and your telescope?
Not the telescope. I bring the telescope is too big, so I bring it out only in springtime when his when the nest is active.
Mm-hmm.
But every day of the year, I go with my regular lens. It's a Canon 400 millimeter lens, and because he moves a lot. And the telescope is too big to follow him with that, and unnecessary too.
Now, do you think Pale Male has come to recognize you as a special friend in some respect?
I make a lot of eye contact with him, and as I said, in my little fantasy world, maybe we do have some sort of relationship. But a lot of times, I'm alone with him, and I'm just like maybe 11 yards away from him. And I look around to see if anyone is watching, and then I say, hey, you know, I try to talk to him. And I'd be like, hey, pal, it's me. And he completely ignores me.
I didn't want to hear that.
And it feels sad at first, and then it feels good.
Yeah.
Because, God forbid, you want this hawk coming and sitting on my camera and being just a circus animal, you know. So it actually feels really good. Know that he completely ignores me at times like that. And, you know, let it just be fantasy. Let him just live his world and let me just be able to just follow him and watch him and try to learn from him.
In reality, that's probably how you get the most out of it, is to let Pale Male be Pale Male.
You know, if one day there's a story that, hey, you know, Pale Male actually sat in Lincoln's camera and was actually looking at him and putting his wing over his head, of course, it will be a novelty once, and then it will be, oh, yeah, that's a circus animal, Pale Male.
Mm.
You know, I don't want that at all. It's how it is. It's beautiful.
Well, it's a very unique story, the relationship of Lincoln Kareem with Pale Male, and it's an ongoing story. And you know what, Lincoln, we're going to call you on a regular basis through time here just to get updates.
You need to come to New York one day.
Actually, I'm going to be in New York in September, so I will call you. And I'll try to meet you in the park.
I'd look forward to that.
That would be great. Well, listen, Lincoln Kareem, again, give your website.
It's palemale.com, palemale.com.
I encourage anybody and everybody to take a look at the beautiful, beautiful, beautiful images that capture the whole history of Pale Male with Lincoln Kareem. Lincoln, thanks so much for
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
There's something to be said about being wild and free as Pale Male flies around his world with no restrictions while we... Well, it's time to enjoy the freedoms we have, and this next segment is a tribute to capturing our memories. Don't go away.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Where would we be without photography? From the first images of the legendary Yellowstone country by William Henry Jackson to the stunning black and white studies by the master Ansel Adams, nature has been well served by the lens and the paper. And now it's a digital freedom. We're all snapping like never before. Time for a few pointers from our friends at Kodak. We're talking photography when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News. Whether it's capturing the grand landscape, going close up with a newly discovered wildflower, or just catching pictures of friends in the high country, photography has changed with the digital revolution. But taking a good photo, take two. But taking a good photo still relies on the basics.
Well, I'm really happy to have as a guest now on the Wild Side News, David Kasnoff, who works with Kodak. David, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Dave, you know, literally millions of people are going to be heading out very often to parks and national parks and rivers and lakes and things like that. Many of those people love to record those moments photographically. Why don't you talk about the trends in photography? Are more and more people using photographs now and cameras with the digital, or what is the trend line on that?
Well, we're finding that consumers in the United States and globally are really captivated by digital photography. It's incredibly easy to use. It creates generally a lot of sharing of pictures, and a lot of consumers find it much easier to print the pictures they really want, whether they do it at home, online, or at a retail store. And even in the event that digital is becoming more popular, there's still a segment of the audience and consumers that finds that their film camera really gives them a terrific value because it's so easy to use. With a film camera, you don't need to use a computer. You take your photographs, you drop your film off, you come back, you get your film negatives, you get your prints, and in many cases you can have your pictures digitized to a Kodak Picture CD or similar product. And if you want to have them in electronic form, in digital form, you can take that CD home, pop it in your computer, and email your pictures much the same way you could with a picture that originated in a digital camera.
It's a terrific crossover that's happening to kind of do whatever you want to do these days. But, you know, nevertheless, whether you're shooting with digital or with film, still there are principles of taking better photographs. I know Kodak has lots of terrific information and advice on that. Let's hear some ideas on how people, as they head out, can create better photographs.
Well, what we generally tell people, the most important thing to do is to keep it simple. And if you either haven't used your camera in a while, or even if you're an avid photographer, one of the smartest things to do is first check and make sure your camera has fresh batteries. Almost all cameras use batteries now. Make sure the lens is clean, there's no dust on it, and just make sure everything works perfectly before they go on a vacation. We advise them to shoot a couple of pictures, finish off a roll that may still be in their camera, or shoot a couple of digital pictures, and then go over to the store, print them, make sure that the results are consistent with your expectations. The next thing to do, just in terms of taking good pictures, is to focus on one main idea or one main subject in a photo, whether it's family members, whether it's a scenic view of the Grand Canyon, whether it's a lighthouse on the shore of Maine, whatever it is, not to try and clutter the picture. And the easiest way to prevent cluttering a picture is to get closer to your subject, really have it fill the frame. Now, zoom cameras make that easy, but a much simpler way to zoom and to get better pictures is to zoom with your feet. Take an extra step closer to your subject, and what that does is it removes a lot of background clutter from your photograph. And another thing we tell people, particularly because the vast majority of vacation photos in the summertime are taken outdoors during the day, we tell people to use the flash on their cameras even if it's bright sun out, because what most people don't necessarily have an awareness of is the fact that at midday, the sun being right overhead, it creates these this glare and shadow on the faces of your subjects. And if you use the on-camera flash, that helps eliminate the glare and the dark circles under the eyes that are just a function of having the sun come from straight overhead. Now, experienced photographers will tell you the best time to shoot really rich, colorful photos is at the beginning of the day before the sun is high in the sky, or very late in the day, just around the time the sun is going down, because then the sun's at a low angle, you get these very nice shadows, you get a lot of contrast, and the photos are much more scenic and similar to what you would see on postcards.
Here's a question that I would have, because I don't really have an answer to this. So I'm taking a picture, let's say, of three of my friends out on the lake, and they're having some fun. Is it better to take a full-body shot or perhaps pull in a little closer?
You know, most people do try and do the full body, and I know, for example, my feet aren't terribly attractive, and you don't need to show them in photographs. Usually, for most people, head and shoulders is fine. Unless they're wearing a very unusually colored bathing suit and you want to capture that, I encourage people to move in close enough so that you crop them at waist level. It's more flattering, it emphasizes the face and the eyes, and that's what most people want to see in a portrait or a candid shot of people, is the face and the eyes.
Now what about the position of the person in relationship to the sun? In other words, should they be facing the sun or should they possibly be in more at an angle to the sun? What is your recommendation?
Again, generally, putting the sun off to one side or slightly behind your shoulders makes for a more flattering photo. The problem is if the sun is directly behind the photographer and someone is looking at the photographer, they're going to squint. They're going to scrunch up their face. The photo won't be nearly as flattering. So the advantage of having side light or sunlight at an angle is that it can create a little bit of shadow and a little bit of depth perception and character in the photo of a person or of an object. And people think that photography is all about capturing light, but it's also about capturing, you know, shadows and the subtle details in the light and darkness.
There's some interesting concepts in terms of composition, the one-third, two-third, that a lot of Kodak photographers talk about. How can you make that easy for us to understand?
Well, you know, in some cases there are digital cameras that you can press the display button on the camera and it'll put what looks like a small tic-tac-toe board over the LCD, the screen on the back of your camera. That's called the rule of thirds, and what it does is it helps you compose the picture. Instead of having your subject right smack in the center of the photo, what professional photographers very often do is compose their photos so that if it's a person or an object, it is at the intersection of one of those crosshairs, the up and down and the sideways of that imaginary tic-tac-toe board. If your camera doesn't have that, just sort of envision that when you look in the viewfinder and try and compose your subject in one of those intersections of the tic-tac-toe board. And what you find is you've got a photo that balances both the subject of the photo and some of the background detail. It's much more intriguing than what we would tend to think of as a mugshot, where the person or the object is right dead center of the photo.
Many people are going to experience wildlife. What are some thoughts in terms of, you know, when you come across animals, what should people think about?
Well, the first thing they should think about is their own safety. They shouldn't take unnecessary risks in trying to get too close to a wild animal. You don't know whether the wild animal is hunting or whether it's injured and therefore feels it needs to defend itself. Now, the great thing is there are a number of digital cameras out on the market today, including the EasyShare, the Kodak EasyShare DX7590. They have 10x optical zoom. It can bring you 10 times closer. This camera and similar ones from other manufacturers can really get you close to your subject without getting in a risky situation. The nice thing about these cameras is many of them have excellent control over shutter speed and aperture, or you can leave them on auto and they'll still take a good picture. There isn't the click typically of a mechanical shutter as you have with a film camera, so it is less obtrusive and less distracting to the wild animal.
One of the differences, the obvious differences between the film and the digital that a lot of people find a little confusing and frustrating, you know, with standard film cameras, typically when you click at that moment, you got a shot. With the digital, there oftentimes is a delay, and sometimes literally it takes a while for that image to mature. That can be difficult, and the person takes a shot, they look and they find out that it's blurred, it isn't clear. How can they help that?
Well, you know, every digital camera, and I mean every digital camera, does something called pre-focus, and it is so easy to get a near instantaneous working of the shutter button. If you compose your picture and then you just half press the shutter button, what that does is it locks the exposure, it locks the focus, and then once you've got that, and there's usually a little confirmation on the screen or in the viewfinder, a little light goes on, then push it the rest of the way and the shutter trips instantaneously. It's 1/10 of a second. Most people are accustomed to pushing a shutter on a mechanical shutter button on a camera, and what they don't realize is the cameras that did that did not have a little computer chip inside that measured the light, measured the aperture, chose the shutter speed, decided whether the color balance was correct. And digital cameras do all that, and it's a computation that takes a fraction of a second. But if consumers got in the habit of sort of pre-focusing the camera, pushing that shutter button down halfway, and then once they've got the photo they want composed, push it the rest of the way, they would get a better composed photo. They'd get the photo that they intended to shoot.
Certainly, if people get out and really practice before they head out and want to take some serious shots, then really learn their camera, because the differences in digital cameras and how they operate are quite significant, really.
Well, pretty much. And, you know, I've seen this myself. I've seen people come to the airport going on vacation, and they're taking the camera out of the package while they're in the terminal.
Right.
They haven't, and frankly, it puts them in an awkward situation. Very often, the battery needs to charge for a few hours before you first use it, which means you're going to not be able to use the camera until you get to your hotel and have a chance to charge it, or your campground and hope there's a place to charge it. They really should take the camera, and even if it's late afternoon or early evening, get it home, charge the battery, go out and take pictures of everyday things just around their street. I mean, the great thing about digital is you don't want to keep the photo forever. You can delete it. This way you get comfortable with using it. You say, oh, okay, it does this. It takes this much time to extend the lens from 1x to 10x, and you get more of an appreciation for how the camera works. Now, truth be known, many digital cameras operate in a similar fashion. They all use an autofocus system. Some have manual override, but the vast majority use autofocus. They all have that pre-focus. They all have a flash that you can set to fire all the time, or not fire, or only fire for red eye effect. A lot of the features on digital cameras are similar. The one thing that's very unique about the Kodak EasyShare system is that our cameras have a share button on the back of them. So if you get a photo that you think is really extraordinary, you can push that little red share button on the back of the camera, and it tags the picture so that later on, when you're downloading the pictures into your computer, the software that came with the camera that you can install on your computer will ask, okay, who did you want to share this with? Or, this is the picture you tagged for sharing. Do you want to email it here? Do you want to upload it to the Kodak EasyShare gallery online to print? And it sort of leaves a mental footnote or a digital footnote tagged to that particular image.
I've heard of the EasyShare. Now I understand what that's about.
Well, one of the things we wanted to do with EasyShare, the whole point of it was that people found digital cameras a little bit daunting, because at the time that they became very, very popular, film cameras were still widely used, and people didn't know how to get the digital pictures out of the camera. They would fill a memory card and go, what do I do with this now? Because it's not a roll of film. You could take it to the store and they would print from it, but you could share. So one of the things we came up with was the EasyShare camera dock, which allowed you to put the camera down on this little dock. It was wired with a USB cable to your computer. You press the little button on the dock, the camera automatically downloaded the pictures into your computer. It brought up little thumbnail displays, and it emptied the memory card, and oh, by the way, while that was going on, your camera battery was being recharged. So the whole idea of making it easier to share the pictures and get them out of your camera and do more with them was the thinking behind the Kodak EasyShare system.
EasyShare. It makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
No, it really makes sense. It's a great concept. I know that very often it's easy to fill up a card. And quite honestly, card management, in other words, the digital cards that you're saving these things on, is an important part of really enjoying the photographic experience. Because if you just clutter up your card with photographs, every time you go and look at that card, you've got to go through all these things to try to figure out what's the most current, most interesting photograph. How about digital editing? Give us some advice about that.
Well, the nice thing about digital photography is it lets you manipulate your photos a countless number of ways. And you don't need to, you can spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars on professional digital editing software, or you can use free software. When you buy a Kodak EasyShare camera, or when you get your film pictures placed on a Kodak picture CD in digital format, both of those products come with the latest version of Kodak EasyShare software.
Hmm.
And this software lets you do minor editing and some very creative things. It lets you lighten your photos. It lets you change the contrast. It lets you do a little bit of sharpening so that if something is not quite in focus, you can digitally enhance it. It lets you do some wild things, turn your photos to black and white or sepia tone. You can create an artificial fisheye look in your digital pictures. You can download the EasyShare software for free from our website, www.kodak.com. And like I say, EasyShare comes at no charge. The nice thing about it is it lets you play with your pictures. They don't sit in a shoebox and gather dust. You can do more with them. And from EasyShare software, you can email them. And you can order prints from the Kodak EasyShare gallery online, all from that software. So it's a great tool for doing more with your photographs. The one thing I caution people to do is to remember, what the subject of the photograph is and not over-correct or overplay with the photo. It's fun, you can have fun and do a fisheye type photo of your son or daughter, but remember, it's a photo of your son and daughter. If you want to keep it, don't over-correct it. A lot of people, very common practice, because some of the software lets you do it so easily, is to over-sharpen photos. And in doing that, sometimes it creates very ghastly-looking halos around people, and they almost look otherworldly. And very often with digital image editing, what I tell them is less is more. Do less tinkering with it than you think you want to, and the photo will be very satisfying, and it'll make a nice print.
That's absolutely true. I know that with the digital editing capabilities now, you can do almost anything, but you can also spend a lot of time and end up saying, I should have left it the way it was.
Mm-hmm. Very often, I find that I shoot a lot of events that friends and family take part in, and a lot of them take place indoors in social halls and schools, and schools don't have the best lighting in the world. Schools, they're trying to keep their costs down, so they use fluorescent lights, and historically fluorescent lights created a rather unpleasant greenish cast in the background. Well, you can adjust that
mm-hmm.
in EasyShare software and a number of different software packages and sort of make it all pleasant. But remember that what you want to come away with is not so much the background being changed. You want, good skin tones that are identical to the natural skin tones of your subject. Again, that's the point where you can correct the picture to the point where it's really, overcorrected and the skin tones don't look natural.
Also, some advice on how to make sure, now that you've taken all these photographs, and particularly around the 4th of July, some of these cameras are going to be exposed to some pretty high temperatures and sunlight. What should people be concerned about there?
Well, whether it's a film camera or a digital camera, what I urge people to do is you can go out and buy a very expensive water-resistant camera bag, and there are some excellent ones out there, but they usually say, I have a big camera bag, and if you're at all in an area where there are some unsavory people around, that's sort of an advertisement that says, steal this bag. What I tell people to do is go out and buy a $3.99 cooler bag, the kind of thing you'd carry a lunch in to the beach or to the park. Usually it looks pretty much like a cooler bag. And it doesn't say, I have an expensive camera in here. The nice thing about it is you get some protection from the elements. It's waterproof. It's unobtrusive. Many of them now have a lot of pockets. And it's also, you know, while you buy it, many of them come with these little freezable, reusable ice packs. And I say, you know, put that little ice pack in a little Ziploc type resealable bag and stick that in your bag with your camera and its film, or with the camera and its memory cards. The cold won't hurt the camera, and the cold actually will help protect the film and keep everything working optimally.
Because if either film or digital cameras get too hot, you lose
right.
Where it goes.
Well, and you know, frankly, what many people don't always realize is that digital cameras are like carrying around a tiny little computer, and everyone has had the situation sometime in their life where their computer has failed because of excessive heat, because the fan in the computer wasn't operating properly. And a digital camera will get warm when you use it, because when you draw on its internal battery, it's a little reaction there that creates heat as a byproduct. So, you know, those are some easy things to do. The other thing I tell people is to, you can pick these up almost anywhere, buy a mini tripod. Hmm. Virtually every camera in the world comes with a little tripod socket in the bottom, and you can buy a mini tripod with bendable wire legs or even mini retracting legs for really about $5 or less. And that allows you to do two things. It allows you to do photographs without flash, because you can turn the flash off, take longer exposures. If the camera's sitting on a tripod, it's not moving, there's less camera shake, you get a better photo with natural light. The other thing it allows you to do is use the self-timer on the camera and include yourself in some of these pictures. And you don't have to carry a big professional tripod if you have one of these little pocket ones. And, you know, I know people who just keep them in their briefcase.
They're fabulous. 3, 4, 5 inches tall, and
that's all you need.
They work perfectly, studded on a table or on a car or whatever, yeah.
And if you don't want to use that, a little beanbag will actually provide some stability. Hmm. The whole idea with any kind of photography is to reduce shaking of the camera, and you get sharper photos. And if you have any kind of shake in your hands, using a mini tripod or a beanbag or some other firm support will dramatically improve your photos.
Dave, what's happening at Kodak these days that people are going to find exciting in the years ahead?
Well, our emphasis has been on always, you know, providing great ways to take and share and print photos. One of the things that we're very excited about this fall is the introduction of our Kodak EasyShare 1 digital camera, which will be the first camera to use wireless technology. What that means is you'll be able to take pictures with this camera, and if you're in a Wi-Fi hotspot, say a coffee shop or a library, or even at home if you have a wireless network, you'll be able to beam the pictures, if you will, from the camera into your computer or online to the Kodak EasyShare gallery right from the camera.
That is really, really fun. That's really cool.
Yeah, and one of the nice things about the camera is it will have the largest, one of the largest LCD screens, so even people who, you know, are uncomfortable using the little ones, this will have a 3-inch diagonal screen. It will have 256 megabytes of onboard memory, which means it will be able to hold hundreds of photos right in the camera. The camera will actually, in its own way, be an EasyShare photo album, because you'll be able to view them right on that 3-inch screen. And you'll be able to create little albums online, actually comes with a tiny little stylus, because the screen on the camera is a touch screen. It'll let you say, choose this album, send these pictures using that touch screen. And the whole idea here is, again, to make sharing pictures and printing pictures simple. One of the fun things about it is you'll be able to walk into a retail store that has a Kodak picture maker kiosk and beam the pictures right from the camera into the kiosk and have them printed.
You could possibly even beam them to your palm or your iPad or something like that as well?
Sure, anything that is Wi-Fi capable, it should be able to interface with.
The one thing I think is interesting that you keep on mentioning is this online gallery. That you mean it's possible to upload photographs to the Kodak gallery and share them with your friends?
Oh, sure. The Kodak EasyShare gallery, it's kodakgallery.com, is a website where you can upload at no cost all your digital pictures and put them in little albums and send notes to people, send little slideshows to people. It's more like an invitation to come view a slideshow of these pictures. and both you and they can order prints and photo gifts and t-shirts and mugs imprinted with photographs and photo books of your vacation online. The storage is limitless. The storage is free.
Wow.
I have a couple of thousand photos on KodakGallery.com that I'm able to share with anyone with an email address. And it's easy and very convenient. You don't have to, if you don't want to drive to the store, you can do it from the comfort of your living room. And then they'll mail you the photographs.
So this is open to virtually anybody that just wants to use the service?
Anybody.
Why don't you give that website again?
It's www.kodakgallery, all one word, .com.
David Kasnoff with Kodak, I want to thank you so much. You're going to head out and have some fun this weekend?
Oh, you bet. I have some hot dogs to burn, so I'm looking forward to it.
Sounds like a great weekend. Thanks, David.
You bet, Sydney.
And when you find yourself without your camera, there's always that good old pencil and paper to render the wonder. Five secrets to better nature drawing are about to be unveiled. I guarantee you, you'll improve any drawing you do if you just listen up. So stay tuned.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
I don't care if you're a budding Da Vinci or a bungling beginner. There are some secrets to making good drawings. So grab a piece of paper and a pencil and get ready to have some fun as we explore some of the secrets of the master artists. When your voice of the earth returns, hear the Wildside News. I've been pleasantly surprised to see that some of the most popular segments on the Wildside News are those that help people learn how to draw and do field studies. I've already done three so far and have links to each of them on today's show page. I've introduced you to journaling and the thumbnail sketch. We've walked our way through field journaling and given you an introduction to drawing plants. I guarantee you, if you've put in a little time on those lessons, you've made some real progress. And no matter if you've taken the earlier classes or not, I'm about to give you five secrets to making better nature drawings. As usual, here's how this works. Because the show is streaming on the internet, you can easily pause any segment from your player. So what that does is let you listen to a new technique and practice it. And you can always go back and listen again. And when you're ready, just hit the play button and continue. It's best if you have some paper and a pencil or a pen or whatever you like to work with. I'm kind of going on here so that those of you who don't have something available can get it. So let's have you get some supplies if you don't have them now. Okay, to best follow along, here's what you need to do. You'll need to click from the show page and go to the instruction page. Look on today's show page segment towards the bottom. Click where it says to, and then get ready. I'll play a little music here while we get started. Okay, let's get started. You should be on the special art page which says 5 Secrets to Better Nature Drawing. You notice that it has writing on the left-hand side and then images on the right-hand side. We're going to go through these one at a time. And as I said, I recommend that you follow through. You can always pause the show as we go along and practice a little bit and then just hit the play button again to continue. And you can always drag the little cursor back a little bit if you want to repeat something. Or just listen to the whole thing or even print out the page. There's a lot of ways to approach this. Okay, are you ready? Here's secret one. And quite honestly, this isn't exactly a secret because this is one of the most important things that I stress all the time. Nature, all living things, are composed entirely of beautiful curves. So what I'd like you to do is look at the images there in segment A. And you'll notice, for example, the two little leaves, the green one and the red one. The green in this particular case represents a drawing that utilizes beautiful curves. The red indicates how a lot of people may sort of sketch things in. And it's okay. It's not that it's wrong to do it that way, and some people enjoy that. And if done actually right, it can have a really fresh and fun look. However, if you're trying to render properly the living earth, then you must learn to do and render beautiful curves, as you'd find in A. So some of you may wish to pause at this point and practice A. B is another example. This could be, for example, a blade of grass. And you'll notice that the green is composed of beautiful, long, elegant curves. Whereas the red, again, has more what an instructor used to call sketchy baloney lines. And that's a good term, actually. And it works, but if you're trying to render properly, you need to, again, render with the beautiful curves. I use as an example of why this is important. See, I've drawn an eyeball there. And we all know that the eyeball is extremely sensitive to virtually any variation. And strangely enough, that's sort of how it works with our eyes when we look at art. The eye will go to the thing that's wrong. We're going to talk about that even more in Secret 2. So therefore, if you're drawing an eye, you really want to create beautiful, smooth curves, because otherwise it's irritating. Literally to look at an eye with irregularities is very off-putting. So in D, in segment A there, what I've done is just showing you some of the ways that you could just experiment with drawing long curves. When you're not doing something, or if you're busy actually working on your art, then just take and create long, elegant curves that are beautiful. You don't want to make them too awkward. You don't want them to change radically. You want them to be smooth. And then just to really make the point that in nature, all living things are composed of curves, and I also say there are no straight lines in a living world, I've drawn and provided two perfectly straight lines to show you how awkward they feel in the natural world. They just don't fit. So stay away from any straight lines when you're rendering the living world. You may wish to pause at this time and practice, or we continue. Secret 2. Create smooth and even shading. Here's a really important secret. The eye goes to the thing that's wrong, and there's a good reason for that. And that is that if the eye wasn't attracted to the thing that's wrong, probably none of us would be listening to this show right now. When we're living in the world, we can have millions of inputs at any particular second, and everything is okay. But let one little tiny thing go wrong, and we reflex and notice that. The same is true in art. Why is that important? When you do shading, and most people like to add some sort of color or shading, many, many, many people, as they're doing the shading, put it in kind of a random, you see a lot of lines and irregularities in the shading. And here's the problem with that, and that is that the eye is trying to figure out, is that an important detail? Is there a white area there? Is that supposed to be telling me something, or is it not? And the brain becomes obsessed with trying to figure out what all that stuff is, as opposed to reacting to the beautiful form and the beautiful fill that you do when you create a perfectly even shading. Now, the even shading is extremely easy to do. What it primarily means is that you do not change the pressure of the pencil that you're using to do the shading with. Just practice that. Just take the pencil and be sure that you keep an even pressure. And you'll find that you can even, the pencil can even stay in one place and it really isn't getting any darker. But as soon as you put more pressure on it, you're going to find that it creates a darker line. Or if you have less pressure, it's not going to be as dark. So the secret to even shading is to use an even pressure and just color in as carefully and evenly as possible. And what you end up with is beautiful forms with beautiful texture. And therefore you can see the art as opposed to the irregularities. So you may want to just practice that. You may want to just pause here again and try shading. This is something that is really easy to do, but it may take some practice. Some people may find it hard at first, but at some point you'll go, oh, I get it. It's like with anything in art. You simply have to practice to master the techniques. Now let's move on to secret 3. Creating illusions of depth. I'm going to read what is here. Light curves around objects. What that means is that when light actually hits something, by the nature of light and objects in space, the light curves. And what that does is it actually creates a little area of disturbance in the air around the object. You'll probably never notice it in reality. However, when it comes to drawing, it serves a very useful purpose. When we look at example A, if you were to try to identify which one of those crossing lines was in the front, it would be anyone's guess. You really couldn't tell. But when you look at example B, you'll notice that, for example, the line that is totally unbroken appears to be in front. The line that passes behind that with the little gaps moves right behind it, and that's just plain the way it works. So you don't have to be obsessive about this, but try to be at least conscious of it, that if you're trying to indicate depth with different objects overlapping one another, leave a little gap, a little area of white between the forward object and the object behind it. You can just draw some lines. Therefore, it's actually easiest if you draw the closest line first and then draw the next line in, leaving the gap, and keep on going backwards that way. It's really quite exciting to see the effectiveness of that technique or that secret. Again, you may wish to pause at this point and practice. So now we continue. This is secret number 4, changing values. To accentuate the varying depth of objects, always vary their values. Let's take a look at example A. What I've done here is I've drawn actually A and B. I've drawn essentially the same images, and in example A, in terms of the leaves, I've created the same value. That has to do with its darkness or lightness on all of the leaves. And you can see that if you had to try to tell someone which leaves are in front and which leaves are behind, you really couldn't do so. But here is the secret. And that is when you're trying to create this illusion of depth with objects in particular that cross over each other, change the values. Always change the values. And don't even worry too much if what you're looking at works that way. It doesn't really matter. Just change the values. For example, in B, as we look to the leaves to the right there, you'll notice that some of the leaves, which I happen to have put in very dark, tend to be way in the distance. And then the other leaves are on top of the distant leaves. And it's very, very obvious. It's primarily the same drawing that I did in A. I just varied the values. And that's a critical element of trying to move objects in space relative to one another. And it also helps to identify and clarify an object in space, because as its value is different than another object, it stands out alone. Here's another aspect to that. another, this is like secret, sub-secret 4A. And that is that when values become the same, that is if it's very dark on top of very dark or very light on top of very light, they flatten. They just plain flatten. So dark on dark flattens. Light on light flattens. Therefore, if you have great contrast, it really creates a large distancing between the objects. And what's fun about that is the fact that you can, therefore, tend to actually move the objects as you're creating them in space by varying those values. If you wish one part of an element of your drawing to close in on an object that perhaps is behind it, make the values similar. And if they end up being the same, they'll literally melt into each other. It's a very interesting process, so you have to do a little bit of thinking ahead in order to accomplish this. This is one that you can have a lot of fun, particularly if you like to do sketches and shading with a pen and ink or pencil and colored pencil and things, because it works so effectively. You'll find that your drawings really take on a life when you utilize that technique. Now for our final secret, and this is a rather interesting one, and it's subtle, but very, very important. And that is the process. It's a technique of intermixing colors. Many artists who are starting out, when they're wanting to use color, they may have a 24 color, colored pencil set or something, or they may be working with watercolors, or it could be with, paints out of a tube. And what they do is they take those colors, let's say it's a colored pencil, which in this case, E, that's exactly what I used. And I chose three colors, a kind of a bluish green for the leaves, a yellow for the petals, and a magenta for the center of the flower. What a lot of artists do is they just take those and they use those colors and they create their images. The trouble with that is the fact that in many cases those colors will appear scandalously inappropriate next to each other, and nature never does that. You never look at a flower and say, oh my gosh, that flower doesn't go with those leaves. They are always similarly enough related in color dynamics so that they get along. They rest with each other. And of course, that's because literally they're related genetically. And that's the important key. When you take colors straight out of a colored pencil box or paints or whatever, put them on the canvas, they may have no real relationship with one another. So what you need to do, just like you would, for example, in looking at a family and saying, gosh, they all kind of look alike, is intermix, in essence, the color genes. That's what I've done in the flower and leaves in example B. I colored it exactly the same as A to start out with. But then, for example, I took the yellow of the petals and I colored over the leaves with the yellow and intermixed that. Now we have a little bit of yellow with the green, and there now the genetic colors are mixing. As well, I took the magenta and did the same thing. I also very lightly colored in the magenta over the green, very, very lightly. And then I also took the green and went over the yellow leaves, petals, and as well the center dot of the flower. And I took the magenta, I intermixed all the colors. Now, if you're working with watercolors, that's really very easy to do. You just take and you make sure to try to intermix just even the tiniest little bit of one color with the next. And what will happen is the fact that they will then be genetically related, and they tend to tone them together. And in that process, you actually accomplish two really powerful things. One is the fact that, therefore, in that particular plant or flower, there are no scandalous colors. They actually are related to each other, and they sort of rest. It also accomplishes this, and that is that as you mix, for example, the green and the magenta in with the yellow, it starts to create a vibrancy, more life, more vitality of that color. It brings it to life. That's what vibrancy is. And it's caused by multiple colors creating the illusion of a single color. And the other thing is that when you do that, then you make all of the colors rest with one another. That's how nature works. So if you wish to create drawings and sketches and watercolors and paintings that really reflect the way that nature is, these are five secrets that just plain work. I'll review very quickly. One, everything in nature is composed of a beautiful curve. There are no straight lines in nature. If you're lost on a mountain or on a hillside, and you're truly lost, and you're trying to figure out how to get back to civilization, you stand up and you scan, and what you're looking for is a straight line, because that straight line will represent a house, a telephone pole, a fence, something human-made. Secret two, create smooth and even shading, because the eye goes to the thing that's wrong. Secret three, creating illusions of depth. Light curves around objects and therefore distorts the air around that object. Therefore, leave very slight clear or white areas around an object in front, and it magically determines and helps the viewer understand the relationship of the objects. Secret number four, change the values. To accentuate the varying depths of objects, always vary their values. And then secret five, intermixing colors. In nature, there are no scandalous colors. So the secret is, always intermix the colors that go into making up a particular plant or flower. This would be the leaves, the petals, whatever it may be, because then that flower will have a genetic color relationship and appear much more natural. I encourage you all to participate in my ongoing art series. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be ramping up the art side of the Wild Side News in the weeks and months ahead here. I'm excited about that. And if you haven't had a chance to go through the three previous art lessons, this is a good time to do it, or at your convenience. So now, as summer starts ramping down, it's best to make the most of what's left. So I want each of you to take a long walk into a natural area soon. This weekend, for example, head on out to a favorite overlook and just listen. And take the time to let the magic of the mystery penetrate. And then, we'll see what's up next week. Until then, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until next Thursday or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.